great music of the time, selected by Peter Simon. Thanks for coming in, Peter.
Thank you.
And why did you pick that one? Was it because it was a great hit song?
Well, it was back in my younger days. I celebrated my 74th birthday the other day, so
really?
I look back with fondness
on those
times.
It was a fantastic song and a fantastic time. But what about this story about the Catholic bishop talking about a bunch of people who were involved in the Waratah Whisperer? Or whisper. It's not often that a bishop talks about a footy newsletter from the pulpit. What was so offensive about it?
That's right. The Waratah Whisperer was an inoffensive little sporting, the Waratah Sports Club newsletter, and it was a Roneoed sheet. But up from Sydney came one of the most colourful journalists in Australia at the time in the 60s, called James Ramsey. And Ramsey decided, he looked at this little Roneoed sheet and said, look, I can put some real life into this. And he converted it into he called it the Waratah Whisperer, and put photos of nude girls, took the mickey out of the establishment in town, sent up all kinds of things. It was registered with the Indonesian Bureau of Culture for transmission by smoke signals to Bagot Aboriginal Settlement. So you get the picture of the madness that was behind it.
Yeah.
But the first edition had a photo of a topless girl, and the paper was actually printed at the Northern Territory News, and the editor, Jim Bowditch, saw it being run off the press and said, oh my God, a nude girl, and he stopped the presses and insisted that they draw a brassiere on her, but nevertheless it went out. And because of the treatment, because of the send-up of everyone in town and the double entendre jokes, the bishop at the time was Bishop J.P. O'Loughlin, spoke out from the pulpit. He said it wasn't a publication that Catholic businessmen would advertise in. And Jim Bowditch was horrified at this. He thought if they withdraw their advertising from the NT News, it'll have a dramatic impact on us. So he actually went down and saw the bishop and discussed how he had modestly instructed that a brassiere be drawn on this naked girl. It would have been great to have been a fly on the wall, this discussion between the editor and the Catholic Bishop of Darwin, the subject being this naughty naked girl on the front page of the paper. The paper also offended Doug Lockwood, who was the Melbourne Herald representative up here in Darwin, and it offended him by superimposing his head on the body of a woman, and said it was a well-known social reporter from Sydney called Nola Dekavir, who was attending a Government House social party here. Doug wanted to sue the NT News. Jim Bowditch had to talk him out of it, saying, look, it was just a publication to raise money for a sports club. But very reluctantly, Lockwood decided not to pursue it with legal action.
So there was only one issue, is that right?
There were several issues. The reason why this notorious James Ramsey came from Sydney to Darwin was he was out of work in Sydney and on a so-called leper list, not to be employed by any Murdoch papers, because Ramsey was a very good sports reporter and he had written an article about a top Australian golfer who was very big on the international scene, Peter Thompson. And it upset Peter Thompson. And at that time, the Murdoch papers were syndicating Thompson's golfing clinic, and they didn't want to upset Peter Thompson. Yeah. So Ramsey got the bullet. The word went out that he wasn't to be employed on any of Murdoch papers. Peter Blake, another journalist who came up here, said to Jim Bowditch, look, can you employ Jim Ramsey? He's a really good sports reporter in Darwin, but there's this problem that he's on the leper list.
Yeah.
And of course, the NT News was owned by Murdoch. And Jim said, oh, well, that's a bit of a problem, but look, yeah, tell him to come up to Darwin and they won't know he's up here and we'll get away with it. But of course, Ramsey came up here and they changed his name, the spelling, from R-A-M-S-A-Y to R-A-M-S-I-E and made him Jim Ramsey. And but
this is very naughty of Jim Bowditch, isn't it?
He put his neck on the line, you know, but Jim was like that. Jim would help anyone in trouble. Of course, in Sydney, as soon as they saw a name Ramsey, they said, this is not the Ramsey, is it? And Jim got telephone calls from executives down there saying, this Ramsey, it isn't the James Ramsey, is it? And he said, oh, no, it's just a local reporter here. No? And they said, no, can you describe him? And Jim said, oh, he's just an ordinary guy. On one telephone call, the instruction was sack that Ramsey.
Yeah. Was that the language they used? I bet you not.
And he didn't sack him.
Yeah.
One request was send us a photo of this Ramsey so we could check him out. And eventually from Brisbane came a Murdoch executive certain that this Ramsey was the notorious Ramsey. And Jim Bowditch said to Ramsey, look, this guy is coming over, play it cool. We might be able to convince him that you should be kept on. And the executive duly arrived. Ramsey was summoned into the presence of this guy, and he was pretty nervous, the executive. And he said, look, Editor Bowditch put his career in jeopardy by employing you. And at that, Jim Ramsey said very firmly, they could stick the job where the sun doesn't shine, very, very clearly. And he was going to leave anyway and start up an opposition newspaper with some of the staff from the Northern Territory News. And he was going to torpedo the Northern Territory News. You can imagine the impact this had on the executive. Ramsey went out.
But how did Jim Bowditch feel about that? Did he know it was...
Well, Jim could cope with any situation. And Jim, in later years, described the situation to me, rolling around laughing, describing what had transpired. Ramsey went and got clapped out printing equipment from what had been the Northern Standard newspaper up here and duly produced this King's Cross Whisper, the Waratah Whisper.
Mm.
And because the equipment was so clapped out, as I said earlier, it had to be printed in the news, hence the episode with the bishop becoming involved. Ramsey was such a, he was a heavy drinker, loved gambling, but as I say, he was a very talented journalist. He didn't stay here very long. In 1964, he returned to Sydney, dead broke, and met up and went and lived in a flat with Terry Blake, the brother of Peter Blake. The Blakes were a media dynasty,
mm-hmm.
Well known in Australia, and he and Terry were broke, and it was approaching New Year, and Ramsey decided that what they would do to end their money problems, they would start a paper, another zany paper, that would cash in on the vast crowds of people that went to King's Cross, the bohemian centre of Sydney, on New Year's Eve. And so they sat down and decided, well, what are we going to call it? And in view of the success
and the
uproar it caused in Darwin, Ramsay said, we're going to call it the King's Cross Whisper. And they sat down, and of course they had very little money, and they raked up money left, right and centre, and they needed £100 deposit to give the printers for a total bill of £230 for 25,000 copies. The only trouble was that later on they discovered that they needed another £40 to pay the people who made the pictorial plates for the publication. That was a separate payment.
Yeah.
So unbeknown to Terry Blake's wife, they grabbed her sewing machine out of a cupboard. They pawned it, an electric frying pan, the metronome of her piano, and a brother, Rick Blake, who'd come up from Canberra, had scuba gear and a spear gun. They snuck that out of his cupboard, took them all up to the pawn shop, and got enough money to pay for the extra 40.
But, you know, this bloke, it sounds like, you know, a cartoon character, really.
Oh, he was. I mean,
was he difficult to work with? Because you were a journo at the NT News, weren't you?
Yeah, he came just after I left. With Peter Blake. I was there from 58 to 62.
Okay.
But I subsequently met up with the incredible Ramsay. He also had a reputation. He had a nickname as the Evil One because of his unusual behaviour and his offbeat sense of humour and the things he did and the odd situations that he got involved in.
Well, the CIA somehow or another he got onto him, didn't they, when he was the editor of the King's Cross Whisper?
And what happened was that the paper, the King's Cross Whisper, was so successful, that first edition, that they ended up in a room in King's Cross throwing money up in the air, and it sold for a 2-shilling piece, and they had basins of 2-shilling pieces. And they all got drunk for days, and they paid off bills, redeemed all the hocked items.
Yeah.
And then they realised that they were on a gold mine, and because it was so popular, and it spread like mad throughout Sydney. People wanted this. What's this crazy publication? And so they then planned for the second edition, but they'd blown all the money celebrating and paying off all the debts. And they went to Jim Buckley ran the hotel in Sydney called the Newcastle Hotel, which was a bohemian hotel, and the walls were covered in paintings. And Peter Blake knew Jim Buckley, and staying in the hotel at the time was Xavier Herbert, the author, who'd come down, who'd written a book on Darwin, Capricornia, and he'd come down from Cairns and was staying at the pub, and when he saw Terry, he said, "G'day, Terry," because Terry had written a story about him in the past, and Terry explained about the King's Cross Whisper and how he was going to bite Jim Buckley for £250 a loan off to pay for the next edition. And Xavier, who was all for sticking it up the establishment anywhere, said to Buckley, "Go ahead. You know what? You've got plenty of money. Why don't you do it?" And so Buckley agreed to pay for the next edition. And it as I say, it became so popular. Within 6 months of launching the King's Cross Whisper, they went from being broke journalists to... Terry bought himself a Mercedes convertible. Rick, his younger brother, who was whose scuba gear had been hocked, was driving a Jaguar. This scruffy James Ramsey rented a penthouse at Rose Bay and had all this modern clobber to wear around. They had parties after parties. Politicians raved, ranted against it. They spoke out about it in various churches.
Were they just having a go at everybody?
Yeah, it was spoof and satire, and they sent up everything from the stars, the horoscope. You know how everyone used to read the stars, still do. You know? And they sent that up. Household hints. Improbable hints on housewives, you know, how to cope with situations. They had a form guide, you know, for horses, you know, which was outrageous. They sent up everything. How the CIA got involved in it, it was at the time of the proposal to buy the F-111 swing wing fighter bomber, and there was debate about whether or not we should buy it. It was too expensive, and as it turned out, it was an incredible investment for Australia. But they used to just, in a spoofy way, send it up. They at one stage they said, we're going to be converted, I think, into double-decker buses, you know, after the rubber bands. It was just madcap.
Well, did you write any of this stuff, or were you just friends with them?
No, but I eventually ended up, I'll just explain what happened, ended up writing so much for them that I bought myself a car.
Okay, so you were part of it.
But they set up, as I say, everything. Qantas, Ansett Airlines, various politicians. They mentioned a new Australian beverage called Croaky Koala, made from ground up marsupials. It was just madness, but it attracted all kinds of writers, and Max Cullen, the actor and film star, he was one of the early guys in the team, and he used to draw cartoons as well. Then they ran ballads as well. A ballad about the sex scandal in London, and they ran other ballads on major news events that were going on at the time. They had a go at police commissioners and anyone and everyone, and of course, some of the girls employed in the strip joints posed for photographs, so they had photographs of nude girls, all these spoofy stories, and they moved from, they expanded from state to state, and every state they went into, every capital city, there was an uproar. The newspaper, the established newspapers, were absolutely shocked by this publication that came out of nowhere. It sold for often six times more than their daily newspaper sold, and it was selling in 250,000 copies every time it came out.
It's amazing stuff. Peter, can you put on your earphones? Because we've got a phone call from Jim, wants to ask you a question about the scene those years ago. G'day, Jim. How are you?
G'day, Annie. Just wondering, Tom Thumb magazine came out in Melbourne exactly the same type of magazine. Was that it? Were they linked at all?
I don't think so, but what happened was because of the success of the publication, there were imitators start to be produced. People said, you know, here's a formula to make a bundle of money. And there were other ones produced in Sydney, and I think... Okay. I know of Tom Thumb.
Yeah, the Tom Thumb magazine. Used to buy it outside Flinders Street Station for 20 cents.
Yes.
Bob or whatever. And that was a great one because it sort of had to behave with the American R&R blokes and all that sort of thing. It was a really great little satirical magazine. So I just wonder if I knew about the new the King Cross Whisper. But, okay, well, thanks anyway.
Yes, right you are then.
Okay, cheers, thanks.
Okay, Jim, thanks for your call. You know, Peter, you've got a wealth of yarns here, and we're not going to have time to fit them all in this afternoon. So how about you come back and see us again? Because I know you've got, you know, I'd like to hear a bit more about your life in the Territory.
Look, I'd like to do that. I was involved in the hilarious attempt to start the New Zealand edition of the King's Cross Whisper.
Were you?
And that is a very colourful episode. I was in Auckland. Do you have much time?
We can talk about that one.
I was in New Zealand working on the Sunday News in Auckland, and the editor of it was John Canning, a very talented newspaper man who was a great layout expert. And John he knew all the Blake brothers, and he knew Ramsay as well because he'd worked in Sydney at one stage. And one day he called me into the office and said, "I've got some amazing top secret news." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Terry Blake rang me from Sydney. They're thinking of starting up a New Zealand edition of the King's Cross Whisper. And he's coming over in a few weeks' time, and he wants to discuss the project with us." And he said, "Could you write down any ideas you have for stories that I might run in the Whisper?" I said, "Sure." I go out to the airport to pick them up, Terry up, and he's on crutches. And he's accompanied by a huge guy who seemed to have a leather fetish. He had a leather hat, leather tie, leather jacket, leather pants. He also had a bad stammer. And as I say, his Kerry, Terry, bent over on the crutches. And it turned out that the Mercedes sports car I mentioned to you earlier, he had driven it away from the journalist club one evening, straight into the sandstone abutments at the Central Railway Station.
Mm-hmm.
And the three occupants, including Terry, were thrown out, and Terry had shattered legs. And so he was, here he is, he arrives in this battered state. I took them to, they said, "Look, we need a car." And they had booked in to the poshest hotel in Auckland.
Yeah.
That was their lifestyle. Everything was done, you know, at the best, and the best parties. And everything. And before they went to the lodge, the White Heron Lodge, they said, "We need a car for the time we're over here." And, of course, Terry couldn't drive it. And the man in leather, for some reason or other, he said, "Oh, he couldn't produce a license anyway. He had another name."
Yeah.
he wasn't travelling under his real name. They disappeared for 2 weeks. They were going to see printers to try and get one to handle print the Kiwi Whisper. At the end of the 2 weeks, and we hadn't heard anything from them, Canning, the editor at the paper, said to me, "I'm worried." He said, "They're supposed to leave today, and I haven't heard anything at all." He'd rung the White Heron Lodge where they were supposed to be staying, and they said, "Well, they're only here for a few days, threw a few parties and disappeared." And I think they were worried about being paid. But what happened was none of the printers in Auckland were game enough to handle it. But they went down the North Island trying other printers. And they got one in Hamilton who said, in the centre of the island, who said, yes, he would handle it, but he must have money up front. So that was arranged. We got a call at the newspaper office to say, "Oh, look, we're on our way to the airport to go back to Sydney." And I went out in an office car, and the man in leather, who we call Terry's manservant, he said, "By the way, got picked up by a traffic cop for speeding on the way to the airport." And he said, "I told him my name was Peter Simon. I said, oh, thanks. Oh, yeah, Peter Simon at the Sunday News. I said, oh, that's good. And then before they went into the departure lounge, the man in leather pulled his coat out and he said, would you like to buy any cheap diamonds? I said, oh, goodbye.
So you were hanging around with some really seriously dodgy types.
So I, soon after that, I had made arrangements to come back to Sydney with my family, and the Kiwi Whisper was launched. It went over with a bang like everywhere else. And it was a bang in more ways than one. Lightning hit the printery, the only printery in the North Island prepared to handle it, and it burst into flames. And people said, oh, divine intervention. No other publisher, printer in New Zealand would handle it. And one of the people sent up in the first edition was Barry Crump, a very colourful New Zealander who wrote books and had been a crocodile shooter at one stage in Queensland. And Barry Crump had been a government deer culler, went around shooting deers, feral deers, and used to write these rip-roaring, rollicking stories. Were self-autobiographical, they were. He was very keen on the use of ground-up deer antlers as aphrodisiacs. So he was a natural subject, you know, for a send-up in the first edition. I wrote a story about him and handed it in before I left. And I subsequently heard that Crumpy was absolutely upset that he'd been sent up. This is a guy, you know,
who spent his life doing it. What a fantastic bunch of yarns. And that's only, you know, the tip of the iceberg. Peter Simon, we're going to have to get you back because I want to hear a little bit more about your life too, not just about The Whisperer. Thanks very much for your company, the Savo.
Thank you. It's been rather interesting
It's been very good fun. A whole different world. Peter Simon remembering this afternoon.